Phil, there are so many great television shows and movies.
That's right. Thank goodness Resonance Rewind has the team to analyze them on a personal basis with Robin Pierce, Jenny Bill, Jessica Burtis, Eloise Sheehan, Alex Lefchuk, and some key additional guests from the Temporal Nexus.
Aren't you one of those key additional guests?
No, I'm the Temporal Nexus.
You know, you've changed my life through dynamic numerology. Priscilla Goodbody, fake $20 bills, and Mr. Bronzini. All crucial elements in the 50th episode of Resonance Rewind. Has 9 letters, which is odd, and my name has 17 letters. It's Priscilla Goodbody, which is odd. I mean, the letters. Now, you see, if you divide your name into my name, you get 1, carry the 8, which is even, from which you subtract the month of the year, which is 5, and that leaves you 3, which is a terribly lucky number. Don't you see? Well, of course we see. But do we actually see whether that was as originally designed by the awesome Arthur Weingarten, who joins us on the program today? We'll hold that thought momentarily as we launch into another Resonance Rewind with a special guest. Of course, Pamela Sue Mann is joining us. Welcome, Pamela. And of course, we've got Jenny Bill, who's managed to get to her hotel in time in Sheffield, which is great. And Robin Pierce, of course, with that epic starting off piece. In terms of Priscilla Goodbody for this 50th episode, of course, of Resonance Rewind. Would you like to take us through what you would see as the précis of Night of the Circus of Death before we invite Arthur to share his thoughts? And they are quite shocking, I can tell you. Off you go, Robin.
Well, I'm going to cheat this week. We have no Gary Girani to help us. So I've gone to tvtropes.org for this précis of Night of the Circus of Death. Now, it's worth remembering for our viewers who haven't really seen that much Wild Wild West, that the episodes all had the convention of being the night of something, pretty much like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was the something affair. So, faced with a possible Faced with a possible catastrophe due to the widespread introduction of near-perfect counterfeit bills, agents West and Gordon attempt to track one which turned up in Denver back to its source. The trail leads first to Moore's Emporium and then to a murdered tightrope walker named Bronzini, an employee of the Colorado and Southwest Circus. When their best bet as to the source of the fakes, expert counterfeiter Harry Holmes, is confirmed to be dead, the agents concentrate their attention on the Emporium and the circus. However, they soon begin to realize that someone in the U.S. Mint itself is involved. Intrigue upon intrigue, Arthur.
Well, yes. Yes, it certainly seems the way you're telling it. I would hire you in a minute to do it. The truth of the matter is, I was appalled when I saw that episode. I never saw it when it aired all those years ago. And it was a favor for Bruce Lansbury, who was the producer, Jessica the son, Jessica's son. That shows you how deep a character can go. He asked me if I could get a script, and he was asking three or four writers. For some reason, they were way behind in this series of the shows. And he asked if I could write it in 3 or 4 days. Well, I took an entire weekend. I was producing the Archer show with Brian Keith at the studio at Paramount. And I had my hands full with it. And so I thought, well, I'll devote the weekend. And I took as the basis for this plot, so I wouldn't have to come up with something completely original, I took the film that I love so much. It was a first independent film for Burt Lancaster called Mr. 880. And it was based on a true story. Edmund Gwynne played a counterfeiter who used plates that he had done for the government when he was an engraver at the Mint. And he used it to do good if in his neighborhood, just odd $10, $20, $50. Most he ever did knock off was $100. And it was going on for years. And Burt Lancaster was assigned to get at the heart of this. And so I used that kind of story as a basis for it. And I wrote it in a long weekend. I stayed up two nights and I finished this thing and I handed it in and Bruce thanked me and that was it. I never saw it until the other day when Annette played it for me on YouTube, I guess, or whatever. I was appalled. There wasn't two lines that left of what I had written. And I thought it was a terrible episode. I thought it was so badly directed and badly produced. The music spotting was erratic and non-professional. And I thought the performances were dead as a doornail. There was more air in it than in a Zeppelin. So you have my take on
wow.
it now.
Wow. I said it was going to be a shocking sort of revelation, Arthur, and it has proven to be so. However, let's take it from the point of view of people's first experiences and let's move to our ace musician and indeed singer-songwriter who I don't think any of your words or indeed notes have been changed without your knowing as yet, Pamela. But equally, you'd be probably surprised if you said, I Want Your Soul sounded nothing like that when I first wrote it. What were your thoughts on the episode?
Well, I was bleeped by Alex because I hadn't thought about the F bomb that was in my song. So I have been edited, but with good
reason. It's true. I did actually edit one of things. So yeah, I am one of those people who did actually rewrite one of Pamela's tunes, but never mind.
Deconstructing. Wow. Okay. So I actually took notes because I've never, thank you, Robin and Alex for inviting me on this
episode.
This episode. So I took it as seriously as I could, given that I never remember facts or names. So I have to just compile all my sense memories and then hopefully I remember those. So this was interesting because I wrote dialogue, very quippy, intelligent, verbose, high speak, memorable food. I don't know what that is. Counterfeit money. Would not get away with this today. Let's see, sexist, teeming with pre-Me Too sexism, of which I am not offended. let's see, blonde bombshells, intelligent brunette, the sexual innuendo off the charts. The money in the petticoat was like, that was very interesting as well. Dynamic numerology. Let me ask Arthur, was that even part of what you had written or did?
No, I wouldn't have a clue about that. I'm telling you, I don't think there are two words or two lines that are.
Not even zany or.
Zero. Zero.
Hot dog.
It's
hot
as
dog.
As if a ghost passed through there and put my name on it. I'm appalled. I have to tell you, there's a little, I'll tell you a quick story about not wanting to take possession of a bad script. A friend of mine also, another time, asked if I could write a script very quickly. for a Lassie knockoff, a Saturday morning children's show called Run, Joe, Run. And it featured a shepherd who did all sorts of incredible things. And I wrote this thing very quickly for him. And he invited me to a screening of it. And I saw it. And it was changed so radically, I said to him, look, I can't have my name on this. I'm sorry to tell you, I think it's terrible. It's hollow of what I had written. And I can't have my name on it. So I'm going to put a pseudonym on it. And I called the Writers Guild, which you had to do in those days when you wanted a pseudonym. And I said, I'm going to put a pseudonym on this episode and I want some formal papers drawn up for this. And they said, yes, what is it that you want? I said, well, it's called Run, Joe, Run, and it's a Lassie knockoff. How about Virginia Woolf? And they said, absolutely not. So that was that. But I had to pick another name. But that's only the second time that I had ever been, I mean, I'm hardly a Shakespeare, but my goodness, I can't take credit for that kind of
character. You've got to think of the hot dog as a portable steak, you know, shared between Jim and Artie. I mean, genius.
No, I had written something which I thought was an interesting take on that Mr. 880 of someone who is doing wrong for good, that concept. And the Edmund Gwynne character was found people. And the reason they sent it in is that the circus traveled around. And so the bills started to show up in more greater frequency because someone had found out what he was doing and was blackmailing him into using the plates more and more and more, you know, large sums.
So clearly the circus aspect actually remained. And we also got the wonderful Arlene Martel as the lion tamer, who was also featured within the whole sequence. One of two Star Trek alumni, possibly three actually, but certainly two well-known ones, Paul Dini being the other, who were actually there. Arlene Martel, of course, Pamela instantly recognised as T'Pring, the intended and betrothed of Spock, as back in the Mock Time episode. And Paul Dini, of course, from Stiles in Balance of Terror. Let's turn to Jessica Burtis. Jessica, I mean, one of the lines, which I must admit, I did find amusing, but wouldn't write it myself, is, now, what is she, 12, 14? Mrs. Moore, my wife is a fully mature woman.
I think that scene sticks out to me a lot because of that line. I was just like, what in the world is going on? Just I felt I didn't know if I was supposed to laugh or be shocked. That was very interesting, I guess. I thought the show was it was a bit different than a lot of the other Western shows that I've seen. When I finished the episode, my parents both were like, what'd you think? Like they're familiar with the show, so they enjoy it. I thought it was like a very I was reading about it, so it's James Bond-esque. The hero was meant to be like a James Bond type of character, and that was kind of funny hearing that. I thought he reminded me a lot of I don't remember his name, the main character from $6 Million Man. I kind of saw that connection, but I was reading that they stopped this show because it was considered too violent. And that was so weird to me. It's super shocking. Yeah, considering especially a lot of the shows nowadays, this one is not something I would consider ultraviolet. Like, I thought it kind of had that, you know, the kind of violence that you see in all the Western shows with the shooting and stuff, and like, you know, the bad guy running, trying to run away. And so that was kind of interesting.
I was particularly impressed with how James West managed to, just using leverage alone, and I thought, this has got to be an Arthur original. So just a Rembrandt, some people find it difficult to find a Rembrandt forgery. Equally, I can now admit that I can't spot an Arthur Weingarten original, because I honestly thought that actually the sequence where James West is actually levering himself up, thanks to his ability to actually not be crushed alive by a very heavy box, but can actually work himself out of the sequence. I thought that's pure Arthur Weingarten, surely. Obviously not.
No. And I do not want to take credit for it.
Well, at least we're putting things right. It might take 50 years, but at least we're putting it right. I'm sure Robert Conrad and Ross Martin will look down and say, yeah, okay, fair enough. We thought it was a genuine Arthur as well. Jenny, what did you make of this one?
I've never ever seen the Wild Wild West before, but I have read about it and I've heard lots of people raving about it. And I was actually really totally underwhelmed because I love Westerns, but I like my Westerns to be kind of epic, like The Searchers or the Spaghetti Westerns, which have a lot of violence in them. I mean, Soldier Blue is incredibly violent, I don't know if you'd call it a Western. And again, like Jessica, I was thinking, this got stopped because of the violence. And I was really expecting really bad violence. And the most shocking thing of all was how on earth Mr. West managed to even move about in those tight pants. I have absolutely no idea.
The good thing, Jenny, is we got the classic gratuitous beefcake scene, which we see in many episodes of the Wild Wild West, where for no apparent reason, we have Robert Conrad topless. As I latterly found out actually through, I think, Sherry Jackson, that was something he liked to do in most of his shows in one way, shape or form, which is important, you know, obviously.
I actually thought it had a slight homosexual overtones, if I'm honest. I mean, that's the impression that I got with the two guys. And then when I see him there with his shirt off and all the rest of it, and I know that they're living together on this train, I kind of thought, oh, it's kind of a bit
well,
creepy.
I mean, to be fair, Alfred Hitchcock did actually use the metaphor of the train going into the tunnel for various reasons as well. How well do you know Bronzini? I despised him. He had a waxed moustache and eyes like a pair of shiny new marbles and a lifelong love affair with himself. Again, why wouldn't you have sort of problems with that? Let's turn to our own member of the team who probably has just dropped a red rose somewhere. It's being picked up and she's nervously sort of fingering her ear at this as we speak because she hasn't got a camera on. Eloise Sheehan, what did you make of this particular episode?
I agree with Jenny and Jessica that it wasn't what I was expecting. I did expect like horses and a lot more Western-y vibes that were just not there. But I'm ashamed to say I actually did really quite enjoy the episode, apart from the sexism and really creepy scenes that were in there that I sort of took with a pinch of salt. But no, I really did enjoy it and I was following it all the way through, which is quite rare for me, actually.
Suppose there was something more than ladies' lingerie wrapped in the package. I mean, again, you know, suppose there was something more than ladies' lingerie wrapped in the package. Was it just shock, Arthur, when you saw it? You thought, I don't recognise this as anything I've written at all. Or was it just a case of you thought that, I mean, were there any characters here that you kind of put into play that you kind of wanted to wrestle with? Because obviously, both yourself and Annette, very passionate animal lovers now, I can't imagine you would have had the lion taming scene in there with the sequence.
No, I didn't. Purposely, of course, I never had anything like that. And as a matter of fact, I had, because I like to get humor wherever I possibly can, I had him thwarted I don't know how many times by animals who wouldn't do anything that he wanted done. So, you know, that may have been a problem also. But no, I didn't recognize a character. I couldn't write like that. As I say, I'm hardly Shakespeare, but there is a certain level that I insist upon, and I seem to have the talent to be able to pull it off. I have never, with the exception of Run Joe Run, ever be rewritten like that. I've had lines changed, I've had attitudes changed, but never a complete thing.
Arthur, I feel guilty now that we've invited you back onto a show which you just sort of thought, what? Pamela.
So Arthur, would there be an episode of Wild Wild West that you would recommend that we should watch, given that—
I never saw the show. Bruce sent me a copy of the pilot script. I looked at it. I mean, I was dealing with a drunk on a show where he drank 20 cans of beer a day, and I had to get an episode out of this guy because every Friday he would leave for Hawaii at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to be with his new wife. So all week long, he was in a haze, and then came 2 o'clock on a Friday, which was a wrap day when we usually wrap the show up. He pulled the plug at 2 o'clock and he took off no matter what. So in between madness.
Was this Robert Conrad, the lead?
No, it was Brian Keith.
Ah.
Brian Keith. There wasn't a scene he would do that he wouldn't turn the minute the director yelled cut. They had his body man hand him his can of beer and he drained it ready for the next scene. Yeah. So, I mean, okay. I was, and he was physically a terror.
If nothing else, we're certainly getting an insight in this 50th episode into some of the behind the scenes work. It's almost like Resonance Rewind Babylon. Robin, any thoughts from your own perspective? I mean, given that there are a lot of parallels between this and, of course, Ilya Kuryakin and Napoleon Solo in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., also a spy series 100 years after The Wild Wild West.
I will put my cards on the table, and other than the feature film with Will Smith, which has name only connection with the TV series, I'd never seen the TV series. It's one of those that, I, as far as I'm aware, it was never shown in this region of the UK, but I've heard about it. And I made the purchase of the DVD box set when Alex told us that we'd be covering a few. So up until this morning, my entire experience of the series had been a few of the black and white episodes, which I really, really enjoyed. I mean, it's a TV Western without cowboys. And it is, of course, steampunk before steampunk was actually invented. And I thought it was ingeniously clever. So all of a sudden, I'm fast forwarding past season two and into season three, and it's all in startling color. And I have to say, thank God for Arthur's honesty, because I'd been looking forward to this. And when I started watching it, first thing I thought was, they've changed the tone of the series from a more serious to perhaps a lighter. I mean, I don't mean the out and out campiness of Batman, but it seems lighter in tone. And I thought this was a really underwhelming episode. And all day, Arthur, I've been walking around trying to figure out how I'm going to tell you this.
You poor couple. Well,
you know, I like Arthur. I respect Arthur. How can I break it to him gently?
Yes, because my wife, Annette, was sitting beside me when she showed me the episode, and she was very silent. Normally, she'll interject and say, gee, I hated that, or I like that. Oh, that's funny. That's all right. She didn't say a word. And when the thing ended, I looked at her and I said, I can't believe this. I never wrote a word in this thing. They changed everything. She said, thank God. I thought it was terrible.
I'm afraid I'm with Annette all the way on this, because I have to admit, I did think that the scene with the building the sort of MacGyver-like lever, I mean, I thought that had the ingenuity of, you know, rolling Wonder Woman or Linda Carter down the riverbank so she could spin and turn into one. I thought it had that kind of ingenuity to it. But I was wondering, where's the usual Weingarten spark to the dialogue? Where's the wit? Where's the insight? Where's the soul of this thing?
Bless you for that. Thank you. Wow. I really have no idea why they did it, but in retrospect, because Bruce and I were quite friendly, and a day didn't go by that I'd run into him at the studio or he'd call me about something, and we had such a good rapport. I never heard word one about it. He did call to say thank you for getting it in so early. Thank you very much. And I'll be in touch. And he never was in touch. My feeling is that he was mortified as I was.
But did they keep the basic structure of your script, Arthur?
Yeah, they changed everything. As I say, I stole Mr. 880, but I changed it enough so that it would fit what I saw in the pilot script. Irony and humor and this steampunk thing, as you say, using things that were not around at that time and were intriguing. But it had heart, because the Edmund Gwynn character in this had his daughter that Conrad was interested in, and they were blackmailing him to tell the daughter about what nefarious things he had been doing. But he had been doing them for good, helping out widows, this, that, whatever, you know, the violin strings would play. And this had none of that, absolutely none of it. And the last thing I would do was have Conrad taming a lion. So offensive, I can't tell you.
Yeah, so interesting in terms of that rewrite. I mean, I'm thinking here, Arthur, is this your Harlan Ellison moment? Harlan, who effectively wrote a completely different script for City on the Edge of Forever. Is this now you in the position thinking, my word, they've changed everything?
Yes, yeah. You invoke Harlan, though. Harlan had a case against every producer he ever worked with, including me.
I'm just intrigued by the notion that Joan Huntington's character, Mary Lennox, would have been seen as the good person or the sort of the sort of positive side of things there. And of course, forger is also seen as a sort of Robin Hood character. I still like the line, I can always tell when my husband forgets to take his pills, he starts banging the table in front of him. You know, surely it's a matter of course for all relationships, really. I keep taking the pills. Jessica, any favourite characters that emerged from this? I mean, directed by Irving J. Moore, of course. We see in the IMDb scenario, Arthur, we have writers Michael Garrison, who, of course, created Wild Wild West, and yourself. Producers, you say, Bruce Lansbury, composer Jack Cleese. But what about the characters, Jessica, in terms of Artemis Gordon or Jim West or Abner Lennox or Erica the Lion Tamer? Who kind of made it for yourself?
I think the main guy, maybe it's because we saw him the most and I haven't seen any other episodes, but I thought he was pretty fun. Like I said, he kind of reminded me of the guy from $6 Million Man, so I thought he was just your classic hero. But I actually liked the, what was her name, it was like the woman that was into the whole numerology thing. Yes, thank you. I thought she was so funny. I think that she was like more of like one of the characters that was like, I think, a little bit, you know, a sexist portrayal, but I thought she was so funny and like eccentric. I thought it was like weird and out of left field, and I liked that. So I think she was probably my favorite character in this episode.
Played by Judy Sherman. What about yourself, Pamela? Anybody from your own perspective that you thought, I might write a song about that? Because, you know, where do I begin?
I did write a song, actually.
We wait with Arthur will be very keen to hear this song about the episode that he denies ever having anything to do with.
The title of my song is called Pointy. I have to agree with Jessica. It was definitely Priscilla Goodbody. And I think from there it just went, and then I really started thinking about the typecasting, and I just like the huge amount of blondes, and especially after our conversation the other day with Patricia, you know, really started thinking about it, you know, the way they cast them, et cetera, et cetera. And that they all seemed to have a sort of blonde bouffant-y hair that was exactly the same, except for the intelligent brunette, who was sort of endearing, you know, in that world. And I was also wondering about that very tight blue suit and if it ripped at all during the episode, because I think it was pre-spandex, maybe.
Very important lines. Eloise, character development for yourself. Were you a fan of James West, Artemis Gordon, Priscilla Goodbody, or others?
I quite liked Artemis, but mainly for the fact that he just changed his appearance. I thought that was just quite interesting, especially with the scene where he pretended to be an older gentleman who was cleaning and just completely got away with being in the room. I thought that was quite interesting. So I liked him based on that.
And to be fair, I think Ross Martin was a very impressive actor who would, channel the sort of inner notion of his training to the role. Certainly there are elements of Sherlock Holmes going into disguise, except in this case, he was very much playing the kind of Watson character to James West's as Jessica said, James Bond character, James West, James Bond. We can see this obviously echoing in the spy-fi theme and so on. Jenny, what about yourself?
I like that arty character, but I have to go for Erica the Lion Tamer because she was fab.
So Erica the Lion Tamer, who's obviously managed to redress her balance, because when she actually portrayed the heroine in the Outer Limits episode, Demon with a Glass Hand, you said no, she was pathetic in that one. So, you know, she just didn't make it in the Outer Limits, but passed muster in the Wild Wild West. Arthur, what about yourself? Did you, having watched it, having sort of, if you can step away from the whole sort of notion of what have they done to my original script, any particular characters that you thought, well, actually, you know, whatever?
No, absolutely not. I mean, first of all, I mean, how much thought can you put into an episode like that? You know, I mean, it is entertainment and it's meant to be what it is. And it had a certain uniqueness to it. I thought it was dreadful. I thought Moore directed it from the grave. It had absolutely no tension. It was very badly produced. The spotted music were all in the usual places and absent from where it was needed. Ross Martin, who was a brilliant actor, Ross was a terrific actor, was very ill placed in that ridiculous thing, shuffling around as an old janitor and this and that. Had I known that that was going to happen, I would have given a heads up to suddenly be in bed with the flu. But no, I thought it was dreadful, absolutely dreadful. And it's shocking to see my name in such bold type on something that I couldn't go near with a 10-foot pole.
It's slap bang on the opening sequence, basically as soon as James West is wandering through the mint in Denver, Colorado.
Big as life. Bruce Lansbury and I are tied together forever.
And that's not a bad thing, let's face it. Okay.
No, I think Bruce was a wonderful fellow. I just am amazed that I think he was too embarrassed to call me. I think
Maybe you could actually sort of ask his sister Angela and actually say, Angela, is Bruce really sort of, you know, she can channel her. I mean, you know, it might be worth considering. Anyway, let's progress. I'm going to be a little bit more generous, I think, than the team here. But Eloise, what are your scores for the Arthur Weingarten version, or indeed actually the edition of Night of the Circus of Death, Wild Wild West episode? What are you going to score it?
I know that people generally disliked it, but I think I'll give it a 7. I liked it, but I reckon I would probably prefer Arthur's version if we ever knew what the original script was.
Yeah, we need that alternate script there. I'm also going to go 7. I might even go 7.5. Jessica, what about yourself?
I think I agree. I'm somewhere within like 6.5 to a 7. I am embarrassed to say that I enjoyed it. It was kooky, but yeah. I had problems sometimes following what's going on, but I've enjoyed hearing Arthur eviscerate it. That was fun. So I'm glad that even if it wasn't written by him, I got to hear a lot of interesting thoughts. I don't know who the real writer is now, but
exactly. This is a classic in terms of referencing. I mean, who would have thought 54 years afterwards we'd still actually be debating this whole sequence? Pamela, what's your score?
Well, being that I know that I could not do this. And it was entertaining, if even for the open mouth kind of, oh my goodness, you know, as a female watching this, I give it a 7. Because, you know, the people work hard, they work. So, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, Arthur and Annette both liked your official dedication to Arthur on the last program that we did. So it all echoes together on that sort of basis. So it's nice. Robin, where are you going to sit on this one?
Well, first of all, you didn't ask me who my favourite character was, and I'm going to go with Artemis Gordon because he is a master of disguise, but you always know who he is. His appearance doesn't change that much. The guy's a genius. As for this, let's ponder for a second, my friends, the irony of a script about forgery. And the script itself is a forged Arthur Weingarten work. How incredible is that? So,
well done.
Got Arthur's name on it, I enjoyed the few frames that we got with Arthur's name on it, okay? Didn't enjoy much else. I enjoyed seeing Arthur's name. So I'm going to, because it's Arthur Weingarten, I'm going to give it 4. Missed out on the other 6 points because it wasn't Arthur Weingarten.
This is very true. Jenny, anything from yourself?
Does it mean, Arthur, that you've now got a script ready to go because this script that you wrote wasn't used? So we might see this in something else now.
Yeah, I have absolutely no idea where that could be. But anyway. I think we let it rest in peace. It's done is done.
Give it, you know? Three.
Okay. And Arthur, I dread to ask for your own score on this one, but what would you score it as an attempt at an Arthur Weingarten work?
Minus 224 centigrade.
Yeah. Next week, we move into the 1970s with the opening episode, of course, of The Incredible Hulk. So we're into the superhero scenario with Bill Bixby. And I believe Gary Girani will be joining us for that point of view. So a whole range of aspects with respect to that. But for the moment, from this episode of Resonance Rewind, certainly huge thanks to Arthur Weingarten for joining us for this anniversary piece. And indeed, that special reveal, which is already sending resonations through this sort of ether, no doubt. Thanks to Jenny Bill, thanks to Jessica Burtis, Eloise Sheehan, Robin Pierce, and of course, Pamela Sue Mann, also delighted to see you. Are you coming back to another Resonance Rewind, Pamela? Would you like to take part in another program? There we are. We're getting the nods, and that's a definite, which is excellent stuff.
Nods always work on radio, don't they?
Silence. Well, the thing I like about Pamela is she also has the cue cards as well that she holds up. It's almost as though, you know, it's genius. You know, the cards are there. It's just it's like New York is written in all sorts of ways. Exactly. Yeah. We'll go to GOT in another line entirely. For the moment, keep on keeping on. We'll have a little sequence from Wild Wild West, musically speaking, coming up. But keep on resonating.
Bye, you all.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.